So Jude, verse 1. Jude, a servant of Jesus Christ and a brother of James, to those who have been called, who are loved by God the Father and kept by Jesus Christ, mercy, peace, and love be yours in abundance. Dear friends, although I was very eager to write to you about the salvation we share, I felt I had to write and urge you to contend for the faith that was once for all entrusted to the saints. For certain men whose condemnation was written about long ago have secretly slipped in among you. They are godless men who change the grace of our God into a license for immorality and deny Jesus Christ, our only sovereign and Lord. Though you already know all this, I want to remind you that the Lord delivered his people out of Egypt, but later destroyed those who did not believe. And the angels who did not keep their positions of authority but abandoned their own home, these he has kept in darkness, bound with everlasting chains for judgment on the great day. In a similar way, Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding towns gave themselves up to sexual immorality and perversion. They serve as an example of those who suffer the punishment of eternal fire. In the same way, these dreamers pollute their own bodies, reject authority, and slander celestial beings. But even the archangel Michael, when he was disputing with the devil about the body of Moses, did not dare to bring a slanderous accusation against him, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." Yet these men speak abusively against whatever they do not understand, and what things they do understand, by instinct, like unreasoning animals, these are the very things that destroy them. Woe to them! They have taken the way of Cain. They have rushed for profit into Balaam's error. They have been destroyed in Korah's rebellion. These men are blemishes at your love feasts, eating with you without the slightest qualm, shepherds who feed only themselves. They are clouds without rain, blown along by the wind, autumn trees without fruit and uprooted, twice dead. They are wild waves of the sea, foaming up their shame, wandering stars for whom blackest darkness has been reserved forever. Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men. See, the Lord is coming with thousands upon thousands of his holy ones to judge everyone and to convict all the ungodly of all the ungodly acts that they have done in the ungodly way and of all the harsh words ungodly sinners have spoken against him. These men are grumblers and fault finders. They follow their own evil desires. They boast about themselves and flatter others for their own advantage. But, dear friends, remember what the apostles of our Lord Jesus Christ foretold. They said to you, in the last times there will be scoffers who will follow their own ungodly desires. These are the men who divide you, who follow mere natural instincts and do not have the Spirit.
Well, so second week in Jude, and actually we're having a short break, just the way the weeks go. We're having a pair from Jude, so last week and this week, and then I think 3 weeks of different things, and then another pair coming up. So you've got to hold on till you get the second two parts. But tonight is, I suppose, what you'd call the main body of it, so verses 5 through to 19. Obviously, you know, it's obvious, isn't it? You look at it, it's the big section. It's what he says he feels he has to write to them. He wanted verse 3 to address certain things about the salvation we share, but now sets out to do what he feels is necessary. And as we saw last week, as Michael helped us see, sometimes we need to do that, don't we? You need to address the wrong things first. You need to demolish things. If you're on a building site, you need to demolish things that shouldn't be there first. You can start putting things in place. If you've got a friend who you can see they're getting drawn away, actually, you might say to them, look, you need to stop listening to that or going to that place because it's just not helping you. Sometimes you need to address the wrong things first of all. We've seen these what I'm calling meddlers in verse 4. Certain men whose condemnation was written about long ago, they've secretly slipped in among you. They're godless men who change the grace of our God into a license for immorality and deny Jesus Christ, our only sovereign and Lord. Big clue there is for the problem is in the phrase in verse 3, once for all. Jude is wanting to contend for the faith that was once for all entrusted to the saints. In other words, it's been entrusted, it is as it is, it's not to change. And it seems like they're twisting it and changing it into this license for immorality. And just as we were singing, I was really struck by just the danger of doing that. You know, look at, if you've got the words, no, you haven't got the words in front of you, but I have, and end of verse, the first song we sung, he was pierced for our transgressions, he paid for the guilt that was mine. Now, did Jesus pay, did he give his life so that you can say, oh, I've been saved, I can live a life of immorality now? Of course not. He didn't save us for immorality. He saved us to live for him. We, like sheep, have gone astray. He pulls us back. We keep going astray, and so we need to come to Jude, acknowledging that we're in danger of doing this. We're in danger of getting to our default sheep mode of going astray and being led aside by false teachers who we must remember always are very attractive. Okay, false teachers don't have really big scary faces and thunder from the front. They say really nice things. They call us to do what we want to do, what our natural instincts would love to follow. And yet Jude says, no, we need to contend for the faith that was once for all entrusted to the saints. Contend is that agonized word. You know, Michael drew that out a bit last time. It's about fighting for something. If you've been watching any of Wimbledon, or maybe saw some of the game earlier on between Isner and the French guy, Songa, it looked like it was going to be another long one. It was pretty long. And Isner is famous for being in the game that went on 6 years ago, do you remember? It ended up being 70-68 and spanned over 3 days. You know, the contend word is that sort of word. It's stick in there, fight, don't give up, stand up for it. And how much more do we have something of value to contend for? Don't tolerate twisted versions of it, Jude is saying. You know, tolerance is good, of course, but if for example, one of the teachers of my children started teaching my child that 2 + 2 = 5, I wouldn't tolerate that. That would be wrong. They'd be learning something wrong and destructive for later life, and sometimes it's not good to tolerate things. If you have a look at the motive, just remind ourselves of that in verse 4. They're godless halfway through it, and they're changing the grace of our God into a license for immorality. So they, because they're godless, they change the teaching to fit basically their lifestyles and how they want to live. And it's just not new at all, is it? This is Francis Bacon summarized this very well. Man prefers to believe what he prefers to be true. It's exactly the same then as it is now. Man prefers to believe what he prefers to be true. We see it all the time. We see it in our own lives. We see temptations to believe that teaching over there because it's attractive. We see it in others that we live and work amongst. And then at the end of verse 4, perhaps having heard verse 4, we might be tempted to think, oh yeah, I know about that. I know about false teachers. It can go in one ear and out the other, but Jude says, verse 5, though you already know all this, I want to remind you, because he knows that we need this to be held up in our faces, that we need to be reminded of just how destructive this sort of teaching is and how it brings us under God's judgment. And the main thing is there in verses 5 to 7. There are going to be four points this evening that go through the four different sections. And first of all, so we're thinking about meddling with the gospel. First of all, it's lessons from the past in verses 5 to 7. And there are three little lessons. You can see them. There's one in verse 5, one in verse 6, one in verse 7. And it's all about looking at the past and learning from history. Now, last Friday was an anniversary. Maybe you're aware of the anniversary that it was. It was the first day of the Battle of the Somme. It's 100 years since that was fought, where 20,000 British soldiers were killed just on day one. Just can hardly imagine it, can you? And In London on Friday, there were people dressed as soldiers, as though they would have been dressed in 1916, and they were walking very quietly around parts of London, and they were giving out little cards, little sort of business-type cards. For example, one said, "Private Albert Edward Raven, 2nd Battalion, Southwest Borderers, died at the Somme, 1st of July, 1916, aged 19 years." Just silently giving these cards out to people. Everyone who was there said it was just a very moving thing. And it really brought it home. And it reminds us that it's about people. It's about individuals. It's about people who lived and died. And so are these examples in verses 5, 6, and 7. I think we can look at people in history and in the Bible and think, oh, they're actors, like they're in some BBC period drama or something. They are real people who sin and who live and die, and we are to learn from them. So example number one is this. It's of unbelief. I'm summarizing them with just a couple of words. The first lesson from the past is there in verse 5, and it's about unbelief. Though you already know this, I want to remind you that the Lord delivered his people out of Egypt, but later destroyed those who did not believe. So it's quite a passing reference almost to what happened, but God's people were in Egypt. Think of the plagues, think of Prince of Egypt and various films made of it, and think of God's people enslaved and oppressed by Pharaoh, by the Egyptians, but also quite godless themselves, worshipping idols, we know from Ezekiel. But God was very gracious to them, and on their behalf he did this dramatic and totally conclusive deliverance and brought Egypt as a superpower totally to its knees. And so you think, well, why would the God who does that then destroy them? Because that's what happens next, isn't it? He later destroyed those who did not believe. Is he that fickle? If you read someone like Dawkins, he'd lead you to believe, yeah, that's exactly what God's like, swinging one way or the other. But no, there's a great big thing that's happened in the middle, and that's their unbelief. The fact that God did all of that, brought them into the desert towards the promised land. They were going to be heading there pretty quickly, but they constantly griped and complained at God and how good he was. And so that was the cause. And Jude is just saying, look how evil that is. For God to do that for you and to turn around and throw it in his face with grumbling and petty grievances. God judged them. And he will still judge today. That's the first lesson from the past. Second one is to do with the rejection of authority in verse 6. The angels who did not keep their positions of authority but abandoned their own home, these he has kept in darkness, bound with everlasting chains for judgment on the great day. So they seem to have fallen from their position of favor, not kept within their proper boundaries, the limits that were set by God. And the current position, Jude says, is to be bound with these chains, heading for this future time where they will experience God's judgment. So you could say the people in Egypt have already received it in a sense. These fallen angels are looking ahead to it. You might be looking at that and thinking, well, this is quite a big thing about angels. Do we know much more about it? We don't know a lot more. There are other bits of the Bible that might shed a bit more light, but nothing really that helps us in relation to this passage. So we'll move on. So two examples from the past: unbelief, rejection of authority, and then thirdly, verse 7, misuse of the body, sexual sin, however you want to call it. We see there in verse 7, in a similar way, Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding towns gave themselves up to sexual immorality and perversion. They serve as an example of those who suffer the punishment of eternal fire. And you just need to go back to Genesis chapter 18 to see God declare about Sodom and Gomorrah that they've gone way past the boundaries. He sends his angels to check out the cities to see whether they really are that sinful. Those angels go into the city, presumably there's an opportunity to respond in some way, but actually they end up just wanting to gang rape the angels. Genesis 19, verse 5. The sexual immorality that's referred to here in verse 7 is anything that's not between a man and women who are married. The perversion is just a whole lot more, including the homosexuality that we know was there in Sodom and Gomorrah. And of course, it's a reminder that the anything goes view is not a new morality, but an old heresy. It's right there in Jude, right back in Genesis, and we're living amongst it today. And then the next, so that's the first main section, lessons from the past. And essentially what Jude next does in verses 8 to 10 is say, well, what these guys are doing in the church, in the early church there, what they are doing is of the same order, this is verse 8, as what fallen Israel did, as what the fallen angels did, and what Sodom and Gomorrah did. Verse 8, in the very same way, these dreamers pollute their own bodies, reject authority, and slander celestial beings. So as our heading, let's call it this. So it was lessons from the past, now it's examples in the present. These people are around you, and they're doing the same thing. And it's a reminder to us. We look back at Jude. Jude looks back at the other historical examples. And it's a reminder, actually, that when these things happen amongst us, it's no different, is it? It's still an offense to God. When people do these things today, what they're doing is of the same order as what has gone on and what has experienced God's judgment there in verses 5 to 7. So, examples in the present. There are some interesting bits in these verses. Look at verse 9, for example. I mean, what's going on about the body of Moses in verses 9 and 10? Well, what Jude is saying here is, first of all, these meddlers, they are dreamers. He describes them as dreamers. And that's kind of shades of, if you're a dreamer, that's in the Bible, God sometimes reveals himself through dreams. So he's talking about revelation, but he's saying they're false teachers because they're hearing and passing on the wrong things. They pollute their own bodies. They reject authority. They slander celestial beings. So pollute their own bodies clearly ties to Sodom and Gomorrah. Rejecting authority seems to point to both the other examples, Egypt and also the angels. The third one, slandering celestial beings, sort of takes us into new territory. And verses 9 and 10 are from a well-known text called the Testament of Moses. You read it? Well, you haven't read all of it because the ending's lost, okay? So it's not only an apocryphal book that's not in the Bible, but some of it's lost anyway. You might be thinking, well, why is he quoting from this? It's from Jewish tradition. Well, what we do know is in Deuteronomy chapter 34, when Moses died, it says that he buried him, or he was buried. The language isn't entirely clear. And it seems that the lost Testament of Moses, you can piece together what it actually says. And it seems as though Michael, the angel who was burying Moses, this is in Jewish tradition, was faced with the devil coming to him and saying, that Moses was a murderer. He's a guilty man. I want his body. And Michael responded, not with a slanderous accusation against the devil, but by saying, the Lord rebuke you. Now, there are two ways of understanding the word slanderous accusation. It could be, as the NIV puts it, that Michael did not dare to bring a slanderous accusation against him, but it probably leaves you thinking, as it does me, how can you slander the devil? I mean, he's... Slander presumes that you're making a false statement about someone that brings their reputation down. How on earth can you do that to the devil? But actually, it's quite possible to read this in a different way, that it is a judgment of slander. So Michael did not dare to bring a judgment of slander against the devil. In other words, he's accusing or not accusing the devil of doing the slandering. And I think that fits a bit better with the story from the Jewish tradition, But also it makes sense about Moses and not being able to slander him. And so it's the whole point seems to be, and don't worry if that went over your heads. I don't think I explained it very clearly. But the whole point is that in some way, these dreamers, these meddlers, are getting into areas of theology where they've got no reason to be. And Jude says, look, Michael doesn't even slander the devil when he might have very good reason to. He doesn't do it. He puts it in the Lord's hands. He says, the Lord rebuke you. I'm leaving that to the Lord. I'm not going to slander you. And if even Michael held back from doing that, then how much more should we? And so these meddlers, they're on territory where they're ignorant. But it's not a game, it's destructive. We don't know exactly what they were doing or saying about angels, but it was dangerous territory. And it's a reminder, though, all of this, that when teachers follow this path, when they get into this sort of territory, whether it's to do with slandering angels or polluting their own bodies and teaching about sexual immorality and doing it in the same way as these teachers, actually, it's a reminder to us that this is not a game. It is destructive. Jude says at the end of verse 10, these are the very things that destroy. And, you know, we all know people who have been led astray by teaching, by things that they've heard and they've wanted to hear. They've kind of drunk in and it's led them astray. And maybe you can look back at your own life and see exactly that happening in you. I was using some weed killer the other day, and not on the earth, don't worry, on the patio. My daughter tells me you're destroying the environment. And so I use it on the patio and on the paths and kill the weeds. And I presume it works on the basis of you spray it on the leaves and it's meant to sort of drink it in. It takes it in. And I'm guessing, someone might correct me afterwards, guessing it uses the same sort of principle, photosynthesis. Well, I know that's light, but it's a plant will drink in water and it will take in the sun, but if you put weed killer on it, it will take in something that is deadly to it. And actually, that's the whole point. It's taking in something that it doesn't realize it's going to kill it, but actually that's the purpose of it. And that is kind of what's going on here. Jude is saying, this is weed killer. This is going to kill you. Don't drink it in. Go to the light, the gospel, the faith once for all entrusted to the saints. That is the thing that gives you health. So, lesson from the past, examples in the present, around Jude and in the church there. And then thirdly and fourthly, it's the gravity of it. Thirdly, and then it's going to be the need to be alert to it in verse 17 onwards. So first of all, the gravity of it in verses 11 to 16. Verse 11, woe to them. They've taken the way of Cain. They've rushed for profit into Balaam's error. They've been destroyed in Korah's rebellion. Judgment, Jude says, is reason to lament, to say woe. And I think what he's doing in these particular verses is ramming home how destructive gospel meddlers are, what they do to churches. And there are further examples from history here, brief ones and metaphors. You get Cain, the way of Cain, who was a murderer and was banished from Eden. From God's presence, rather. You get Balaam, who led Israel into sexual sin. You get Korah, who stood against Moses' authority, but also God's authority, and received God's very dramatic judgment as he was swallowed up by the ground. And so we're seeing the gravity of it, but you could divide it into a couple of ways. First of all, the impact on others from these false teachers. You know, Cain, obvious impact on others, killed his brother. Balaam led others into sin. Korah led his family and others into disaster. And there are further metaphors here. The blemishes one in verse 12, these men are blemishes at your love feast. I'm not convinced about the blemishes word being right there. The actual literal translation is hidden reefs, like a reef under the water. It's been translated blemish because the words are really similar. But it seems to me there's every reason to assume it is a reef. And reefs, obviously still today, they are dangerous. If you've got a boat, you avoid the reefs like anything. You know, we have the privilege of going to Wales the last couple of years. We take the kayaks out to the sea, and one thing we'll always say is go that side of the reef marker. It's just the first thing you do, because a reef, if you catch it wrongly, will ground you, hole you potentially, sink you potentially. And these men are causing people to crash on the rocks of their wrong theology. They're also shepherds, but shepherds, notice halfway through verse 12, who feed only themselves. So they're not being shepherds at all. They're not feeding the sheep. They're the sort of shepherds that Ezekiel talks about. They are clouds without rain. Imagine you're a farmer. You might think a cloud without rain sounds like a wonderful thing, not raining on your head. But if you're a farmer and you're looking at your field and your crops and you are praying for rain, then a cloud without rain is a pretty terrible thing. It promises so much, delivers nothing, no life whatsoever. They are blown along by the wind. They're autumn trees without fruit and uprooted, twice dead. Autumn trees should be producing fruit. They're not, and they're uprooted, hence they're twice dead. They're wild waves of the sea. They're turbulent and they're unstable. So they're foaming up their shame. They're producing nothing but churning up rubbish. So there's the impact on others. And then on themselves as well, they're wandering stars. And end of verse 13, wandering stars for whom blackest darkness has been reserved forever. The Bible talks about stars having their courses that are given by God. They don't wander, and yet these are wandering. And blackest darkness has been reserved for them. There's a key word in Jude, which is kept, and we see it in verse 1. Those who have been called, loved by God the Father, and kept by Jesus Christ. And also in verse 24, to him who is able to keep you. It's the same word here, that actually blackest darkness has been kept for those people. Then you get the quotation from, a quotation from another bit of Jewish tradition. It's from a book called 1 Enoch. It's there in verse 14 onwards. Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men. See, the Lord is coming with thousands upon thousands of his holy ones to judge everyone and to convict all the ungodly of all the ungodly acts they've done in the ungodly way. And this is not actually from the Old Testament. It's from this book, 1 Enoch, which might lead us to think, well, hold on, what's going on? Does that mean it's authoritative? Should 1 Enoch therefore be in our Old Testaments in the Bible? Is this quote authoritative? Is it on a par with the rest of Scripture? And clearly, I think we need to say this quote is, because even if it wasn't in the Bible proper in terms of 1 Enoch, it is now, because it's been quoted here. It is now authoritative. And the main point, though, is not to miss its message of judgment that Jude is referring to here. The story goes that George Whitefield preached on a number of occasions in the home of the Countess of Huntingdon. And he felt the need, as he looked at those who were listening, they were very rich, very important people, very proud. He realized actually that they were people who needed to feel and to really understand what it is to be a sinner and to be facing the judgment. And he described the plight of a sinner who's unaware of his sin as a blind man on a stormy night feeling his way near the edge of a cliff. And he, in his George Whitefield way, this is 18th century, imagine him in this posh room of the Countess of Huntingdon's home, He acted the part of this blind man. There's a cliff there. He had a cane, tapping it around, pretend cane, building up this picture of what it is to be under God's judgment. And he painted such a picture that there was one point where he came close to the edge, this so-called edge of the cliff. And somebody shouted out, "Save him, Whitfield, save him!" Because it hit home with so much power. And we need that, don't we? Because we're rather like those people in that room. We're a bit theologically comfortable and complacent, and we know the gospel, we know that God is love, we know what Christ has done for us. Forget what it is, not only to be apart from Christ and not know his salvation at all, but to know him and then to go astray, then to apostatize, then to turn away from him. And we need to hear what Jude is saying about just how terrible it is to put ourselves in that situation. We need to pray that God would keep us from that we wouldn't be sheep who go astray, we'd be kept on the path, on the right gospel, but that we would be roused out of any sort of complacency that we might have about sin and about judgment that falls on it. Well, how wonderful that we have a Saviour. How wonderful that we can also read it, though, knowing that to cling to Christ, to cling to the gospel once for all entrusted to the saints, means that however sinful we might remain day by day, however many times we may fall, that we're safe in him. Well, verse 16, Jude now just gets a little bit more explicit about these men. There's no metaphors here at all. He says, "These men are grumblers and fault finders. They follow their own evil desires. They boast about themselves and flatter others for their own advantage." He's not pulling any punches here. He's just simply describing who they are. And so our final point is there in verses 17 to 19. Because those three verses start to introduce the next section that we'll look at in a few weeks' time, which is basically, well, what do you do about this? How do you respond to it? And there's the first instruction that's there in verse 17. We haven't had any instructions. We've just had facts and truth, verses 5 to 16. But now, dear friends, remember. Dear friends, remember. That's the instruction. So let's call it this. Final point, they need to be alert to it. They need to be alert to it. And Jude is just saying, and he's picking up on a same word that he used in verse 5, "I want to remind you." This is the same word. Dear friends, remember. Now it's in this imperative form, this instruction form. And he's saying, don't be surprised. This is the norm. We get this a lot, don't we, in the New Testament. These are what false teachers will do. We're not to be surprised about it, but we are to be ready for it. I guess it's very easy to fall on two extremes, either to be very naive and just to think that anyone who opens their Bible and talks about God or Jesus is always speaking the truth. And that's dangerous, isn't it, if there are false teachers around? It's one extreme. The other extreme is we're cynical about everything. We're always putting everyone to bits, always finding fault. We're not to bring either of those, but we are to be wise and discerning. We're to know that desires, end of verse 18, and natural instincts, verse 19, do not automatically lead to right theology and right living. Well, a couple of questions for you, just as we come to an end here. How do you need to be contending for the faith in a world where, if anything, there's been an increase in people slipping in and taking the gospel and twisting it? How do you need to be contending for it? And where might you be led astray? Where are you most vulnerable to being led astray by desires? You know, what we want to believe is the thing that we're most likely to choose to believe, or by our natural instincts. How do you need to contend for the faith? And where might you be led astray by it?